Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the deep dive. Today we are, well, we're undertaking a really critical mission, wading into the deep and, let's face it, often polarized waters of carbon capture and storage, or CCS.
Yeah, it's a technology that gets debated constantly. You hear all sides. Is it the key to hitting net zero?
Uh-huh.
Or maybe just a costly way to let fossil fuels hang around longer?
Exactly. So for this deep dive, we decided to move past the rhetoric, you know, get straight to the facts. And we're using a guide here. One of the field's most authoritative and importantly objective analysts, Howard J. Herzog, and his concise primer, Carbon Capture.
Mm-hmm.
Our goal today is really to give you a clear-eyed, balanced understanding. What's the potential? What are the real-world limitations? Is it the silver bullet? Or maybe, as Herzog seems to suggest, just a vital, indispensable piece of the whole climate puzzle?
Indispensable feels like the right word here. It's absolutely essential knowledge for you, the listener, because hitting those ambitious climate targets, it takes more than just switching to renewables.
Right. Renewables are huge, obviously, transforming the grid.
But they don't really touch the massive emissions coming from what Herzog calls the hard-to-abate sectors. Think heady industry.
Yeah.
So if any climate strategy, national or corporate, just ignores CCS, well, it's basically failing to address a huge chunk of the carbon budget problem.
Okay, that sets the stage perfectly. So let's talk about the person behind this analysis. Who is Howard J. Herzog? Why should we trust his take on such a charged topic?
Well, Herzog is he's really a giant in this field, carbon management. He's a senior research engineer at MIT's Energy Initiative. That's prestigious.
MIT. Okay.
Yeah, meaning he's been right at the cutting edge of energy and climate research for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And his focus has consistently been on separating the engineering realities from all the political noise surrounding it.
Because this field is full of noise, right? Passionate advocates on one side, very strong skeptics on the other. What makes his view stand out as genuinely objective?
I think it really comes down to rigor.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't just studied CCS. He's actually contributed as a key author, a reviewer, for major climate assessments. We're talking IPCC reports here, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Ah, the IPCC. That carries weight.
It does. So you combine that deep scientific foundation with his engineering background, and you get this voice that's just committed to objective assessment. He doesn't treat CCS like a political football. He treats it like what it is, mm-hmm. a complex but necessary engineering task.
He sounds like exactly the kind of guide we need for this. Okay, let's dive into the book's core argument then. What's Herzog's central thesis in carbon capture?
It's pretty straightforward, actually. He argues that CCS is technologically viable, it's necessary, and it's a critical component of the whole global climate solution portfolio. Mm-hmm. It's not instead of renewables or efficiency.
It's an addition.
Exactly. It's an addition that's required to fill some very specific non-negotiable gaps in our strategy.
And what's the core insight he keeps coming back to? Because we often hear about the technical hurdles, it's expensive, it uses a lot of energy itself to capture the CO2. Are those the real roadblocks, according to him?
He argues pretty forcefully that no, they aren't the primary roadblocks, the engineering challenges. They're real, definitely, but they are solvable. Herzog basically says the main obstacles holding back large-scale global deployment are economic, political, and social, not technological.
Huh. So the physics works? The engineering works?
Yeah, the principles are sound. It's just that society hasn't really created the policy framework needed to make the, you know, multi-billion dollar investment case for building this stuff at scale.
That really shifts the focus, doesn't it? It takes the conversation out of just the lab and puts it squarely into the world of financial risk, government policy, investment certainty.
Precisely. Yeah. And so the book's purpose, really, is to demystify the whole process, the whole value chain, so that policymakers and citizens, too, understand exactly what they're being asked to invest in, mm-hmm. or perhaps what they're choosing not to invest in.
Makes sense.
So he takes you on this structured journey, you know, the different ways we capture CO2, how we transport it safely, and crucially, how we make sure it stays stored permanently deep underground. It's all rooted in this argument of pragmatic necessity.
Okay, let's unpack that necessity. You mentioned gap CCS fills. Let's start with the climate imperative. Herzog points to two critical emission gaps that only CCS can really address. What's the first one?
The first one, and maybe the most compelling, is industrial process emissions. Now, we're not talking about emissions from just burning fuel for power here.
Okay.
We're talking about the chemical reactions that are just inherent in making materials fundamental to modern life. Think cement. Think steel.
Right, the backbone industries. Give us an example. Why can't renewables just fix this?
Okay, take cement production. You have to heat limestone, that's calcium carbonate, to incredibly high temperatures. When that limestone breaks down chemically, it releases CO2. That CO2 release happens regardless of whether you heat the kiln with clean electricity or, you know, coal.
Ah, it's baked into the chemistry itself.
Exactly. You can't change the chemistry of turning rock into cement. So the only way to decarbonize that specific process emission is to capture the CO2 after it's released, right out of the smokestack.
Okay, that's a powerful case. And the second gap, you said it addresses the transition itself.
Right. This is more about pragmatism.
Yeah.
It's acknowledging that the global energy transition realistically is going to take decades.
Yeah.
Especially in countries that are rapidly industrializing.
We still rely heavily on fossil fuels now.
Immensely. The world depends on a vast amount of existing fossil fuel infrastructure just for grid stability, for energy security. So CTS offers a kind of bridge. It provides a viable path to mitigate emissions from those existing power plants while that slow, massive shift to renewables happens over time.
Okay, so if we accept the necessity argument, how do we actually physically grab this CO2? Herzog walks through three main capture technologies. Let's start with post-combustion. You said it's the most mature, often used for retrofitting existing plants.
Yeah, this is sometimes called the tailpipe solution.
Yeah.
So after the fuel could be coal, could be natural gas is already burned, you take the flue gas, the exhaust, and you basically scrub the CO2 out of it, usually using a chemical solvent like an Emin solution.
Like a sponge.
Exactly. We often use the analogy of a chemical sponge. It selectively soaks up the CO2 from the rest of the exhaust gases.
Okay, but squeezing that sponge out, getting the CO2 back out of the solvent, that's where the trouble starts, right? The famous energy penalty.
That's the crucial trade-off, yeah. To release the captured CO2 so you can pipe it away, you have to heat that solvent, often using large amounts of steam that comes directly from the power plant itself.
Ah, so the plant has to generate extra energy just to run the capture process.
Precisely. And that process significantly reduces the plant's net power output. We're often talking 20, maybe even 30% less electricity available to sell. This extra energy drain is a big part of why the captured electricity is more expensive and why this method, despite being mature, has high operational costs.
Okay, so that's post-combustion. How does pre-combustion capture contrast with that high energy cost? What's the engineering difference?
Recombustion is usually designed for new facilities, and the whole strategy is fundamentally different. Instead of burning the fuel first and then trying to separate the CO2 from the dilute waste gas,
you do it beforehand.
Right. You first convert the primary fuel again, could be coal or gas, into something called syngas, synthesis gas. It's mostly hydrogen and carbon monoxide. Then you react the carbon monoxide with steam to make more hydrogen and CO2, and you separate out the CO2 before the hydrogen is burned for power.
Okay, what's the advantage of separating it out earlier before burning?
Well, the CO2 stream you're separating is much more concentrated, and it's already under high pressure from the gasification process. That makes the actual separation step far easier and less energy intensive compared to scrubbing it from a low pressure dilute exhaust stream like in post-combustion.
Sounds better, but what's the catch?
The catch is usually the huge upfront capital cost and the complexity. You need these big, complex fuel conversion and gasification systems built right into the plant design from the start. It's not easily retrofitted.
Got it. And the third option, oxycombustion. That sounds almost like a purely technical approach.
It's a really interesting one, actually. Here, the idea is you burn the fuel coal or gas, not in regular air, but in almost pure oxygen.
Why pure oxygen?
Because regular air is about 78% nitrogen, which is inert. It doesn't burn. It just goes along for the ride and ends up diluting the CO2 in the exhaust. If you remove the nitrogen before combustion by burning in pure oxygen, the resulting flue gas is basically just CO2 and water vapor.
Ah, so then you just cool it down, the water condenses out.
And you're left with a very highly pure stream of CO2, almost ready for compression and transport.
That purity sounds ideal for capture.
Yeah.
What's the trade-off here? There's always a trade-off, isn't there?
There always is. The big cost here is getting that pure oxygen in the first place. You need a massive energy-intensive air separation unit, or ASU. It cryogenically separates oxygen from nitrogen in the air.
So it's like its own industrial chemical plant attached to the power plant.
Pretty much, yeah. It requires significant capital investment and consumes a substantial amount of electricity itself. That becomes the main energy penalty for this capture method. So you see, For the engineers designing these things, the choice of capture technology is always this complex optimization problem, balancing costs, efficiency, the type of plant, the CO2 source concentration.
Okay, so let's say we've navigated that choice. We've captured a pure stream of CO2, vast quantities of it. Now we have to deal with transport and then permanent storage. What form does the CO2 take for transport, and how do we move it efficiently at scale?
Right, so Herzog explains that to move the millions, eventually billions of tons required annually, the CO2 needs to be compressed, heavily compressed. It turns into what's called a supercritical fluid.
Supercritical, what does that mean?
It's a state where it's not quite a gas, not quite a liquid. It's very dense, like a liquid, but flows easily like a gas. This dense state makes it much more efficient to pump through pipelines over long distances. Pipelines are really the only practical way to move these huge volumes.
But building all those dedicated pipelines sounds incredibly expensive, especially for just one factory or power plant.
It is. Absolutely prohibitive for most single facilities. And that's precisely why Herzog strongly emphasizes the need for CCS hubs or clusters.
Hubs and clusters?
Yeah, the idea is that the economics really only start to make sense when multiple industrial facilities in a region, maybe a power plant, a cement factory, a chemical plant, a refinery, all share a single large-scale pipeline network leading to a shared storage site.
Ah, economies of scale through shared infrastructure.
Exactly. Sharing that pipeline and storage infrastructure is probably the single most important factor for driving down the overall deployment costs.
Okay, now for the really critical final step, geological sequestration, the permanent storage. Where exactly does all this CO2 go, and what guarantees it actually stays there?
It has to be injected deep underground. We're talking generally deeper than 800 meters, or about half a mile down. It goes into porous rock formations that have tiny spaces, like sandstone.
And these formations are filled with?
The largest potential storage sites globally are vast saline aquifers. These are deep layers of porous rock that are saturated with brine, very salty water, that's not suitable for drinking or agriculture. They often lie beneath impermeable layers of rock, called cap rock, that act as a seal.
Like a lid on a container?
Sort of, yeah. Depleted oil and gas fields are also excellent candidates. Think about it, they've already proven they can trap fluids, oil and gas, under pressure safely for millions of years. They have a demonstrated seal.
That makes sense. But public anxiety, you know, always focuses on potential leakage. Could it seep back out over time? How does Herzog address the security, the permanence of this underground storage?
He details what's essentially a multi-layered security system. First, you have the physical barrier, that impermeable cap rock we mentioned. It prevents the buoyant CO2s from rising. Then over time, some CO2 dissolves into the formation water, making it denser and less likely to rise. Some gets trapped in tiny pore spaces as residual droplets.
Okay, multiple mechanisms.
But the ultimate guarantee of permanence, the one Herzog really emphasizes, relies on mineral trapping. This happens much more slowly, over hundreds or maybe thousands of years. The dissolved CO2 chemically reacts with the minerals in the surrounding rock.
Reacts how?
It forms new, stable carbonate minerals.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, it solidifies. It turns the gaseous CO2 back into solid rock, locking it away permanently within the geological formation.
Wow. So it literally petrifies itself, turning back into stone. That's the ultimate long-term security. Do we actually have real-world proof that this works predictably, that storage sites behave as expected?
We absolutely do. Herzog points directly to the Sleipner project, operated by Equinor off the coast of Norway. They've been injecting CO2 captured from natural gas processing into a saline aquifer beneath the North Sea continuously since 1996.
Since 1996, that's quite a long time.
It is. And decades of really intensive monitoring, seismic surveys, sampling have shown exactly where the CO2 plume is, how it's behaving, and confirmed that it's securely contained within the intended formation, just as the models predicted. It's a powerful real-world testament that this isn't some unproven theory. Geological storage works.
Okay, so that brings us right back to the macro challenge. If the science works, if the engineering works, if we have proof of concept for storage, we circle back to the policy problem, the economic hurdles. Let's dig into the specific mechanisms needed to make this happen at scale.
Right, this is where we really have to shift from the technical details to the financial reality. And the first major lesson from Herzog is crystal clear. CCS adds significant cost to an industrial process, but it doesn't typically add revenue. So you absolutely need strong, long-term government policy to bridge that economic gap.
How does society actually create that business case then? How do you make it financially worthwhile to capture and store CO2?
Well, fundamentally, you have to put a price on carbon emissions, or you have to directly incentivize the removal or storage of CO2,
Yeah.
monetizing the act of sequestration itself.
Okay.
In the U.S., the most significant policy mechanism driving CCS right now is the 45Q tax credit. This is really crucial for anyone listening, especially if you're an investor or analyst, to understand.
What does 45Q do?
It provides a direct payment, a tax credit, for each ton of CO2 that's captured, and then either permanently stored underground in places like saline aquifers or used in certain approved utilization processes like enhanced oil recovery, EOR. Currently, the credit is around $50 per ton for permanent geological storage and about $35 per ton if it's used for EOR or other utilization.
So it directly subsidizes the activity, turning what would be just an environmental cost into something with a potential, albeit subsidized, revenue stream.
Exactly. And the stability and longevity of that policy, that per-ton subsidy, is probably the single most critical factor for investors. These CCS projects involve massive upfront capital costs, billions of dollars. Investors need certainty that that 45Q incentive or something like it will actually be there reliably for the 20 or 30 years it takes to pay off the investment. Policy certainty equals investment certainty.
Okay, before we move on from the mechanics, we should clarify something you mentioned, the evolution of the term. Herzog addresses the shift from just CCS to CCUS, carbon capture, utilization, and storage. What role does that the utilization part play?
Yeah, that's an important distinction. Utilization means using the captured CO2 for something economically beneficial rather than just storing it immediately. The classic example is enhanced oil recovery, using CO2 to push more oil out of existing fields. But there are other potential uses being developed, using CO2 to cure concrete, making chemicals, producing fuels.
Does Herzog see utilization as the main path forward?
He emphasizes that utilization is important, especially in the near term, because it can create immediate revenue streams that helps offset the high capture costs and can accelerate investment and learning. It gets projects built faster.
I sense a but coming. Can utilization alone handle the sheer scale of CO2 we need to deal with for climate goals?
Realistically, no. That's the key point. Utilization markets can probably handle volumes of CO2, maybe millions of tons per year. But the scale required to make a serious dent in global emissions, we're talking billions of tons annually, that scale absolutely must rely on permanent geological storage. The potential market for CO2 products just isn't big enough. So utilization is a helpful stepping stone, maybe, but sequestration remains the primary long-term goal.
That makes sense. Herzog's analysis, as you've described it, seems full of these really potent, memorable lines that cut through the complexity. Let's maybe highlight a few of those core ideas that really summarize his perspective.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, first, the headline message we keep coming back to, paraphrased: the greatest barrier to carbon capture deployment is not technical feasibility, but economic competitiveness and policy uncertainty. It just constantly hammers home that the main challenge now is in the realm of governance and finance, not basic science or engineering.
And on the necessity front, there's that powerful line: to ignore carbon capture is to ignore the emissions from steel, cement, and other core industries of modern civilization. That really underscores its unique, almost non-negotiable role for decarbonizing the physical economy, the stuff we build our world with.
Right. And then, to address the public confidence issue, the storage security, he offers this thought, again paraphrased: geological storage of CO2 is not an experiment. It's a well-understood process that has been occurring naturally for millions of years. He's linking CCS storage back to the proven security of natural oil and gas traps, trying to reassure people about permanence based on natural analogs.
That's a really useful framing. And finally, his assessment of the next frontier technology, direct air capture, DAC, capturing CO2 straight from the ambient air. What was his take there?
He provides a dose of realism.
Yeah.
Direct air capture is today where solar power was decades ago, technologically proven but economically uncompetitive.
That's a great analogy.
It is, because it does two things. It confirms that, yes, DEET is likely needed eventually, maybe as a future backstop technology for cleaning up legacy emissions already in the atmosphere. But it also signals that DEET needs the same kind of sustained public investment, R&D support, and crucial learning by doing that solar power benefited from over decades to bring its costs down dramatically. It won't be cheap overnight.
Okay, so pulling all this together, how can a thoughtful listener, maybe someone working in finance, an analyst, or just a concerned citizen trying to understand climate solutions, how can they apply this detailed knowledge in the real world?
Well, for the investor or analyst looking at CCS projects, the big takeaway is this: you now understand that the primary risk isn't some sudden, unexpected technical failure of the capture plant or the storage site. The dominant risk is political and policy risk, meaning when you evaluate a potential CCS investment, your top priority should be assessing the certainty and longevity of the supporting policies, like the 45Q tax credit structure or equivalent carbon pricing mechanisms in other regions. Policy stability trumps marginal gains in, say, capture efficiency when it comes to financial viability over decades.
Okay, that's clear for investors. What about for the concerned citizen, maybe seeing a CCS project proposed in their local area?
Well, armed with this knowledge from Herzog, you can move beyond just a gut reaction, either dismissal or blind acceptance. You can ask much more informed, specific questions. Instead of just asking, is it safe? You can focus on the critical need for robust monitoring, verification, and accounting systems. MVA.
MVA. What is that exactly?
It's the official, scientifically rigorous protocol used to track the injected CO2 underground, to confirm it's staying exactly where it's supposed to be, and to quantify how much is being stored securely. Demanding transparency and strong MVA protocols is how communities can ensure accountability and build public trust around these projects. It focuses the debate on verifiable performance. And we see the importance of getting this right, the learning by doing, sometimes the hard way, in real-life case studies, right? Like the Boundary Dam project in Saskatchewan, Canada.
Absolutely. Boundary Dam was the world's first commercial-scale coal-fired power plant equipped with post-combustion capture. And, well, it was definitely a challenging and expensive proving ground.
What kind of challenges?
It provided invaluable but sometimes difficult real-world data. They faced issues with integrating the capture unit smoothly with the power plant operations, higher than expected maintenance costs, and reliability hurdles, especially early on. But these early, sometimes struggling projects, even with setbacks, are absolutely vital. They are the crucial learning experiences the entire industry needs to optimize the design, operation, and cost effectiveness of the next generation of CCS infrastructure. You have to build the first ones to learn how to build the later ones better and cheaper.
Yeah, that seems to be the core lesson, really. The lasting takeaway for me from this deep dive into Herzog's work is the unavoidable need for pragmatism in climate solutions. If we're truly serious about tackling the climate emergency, it feels like we can't afford to just disqualify a tool that's proven and, as he argues, essential for certain sectors, just because we might have ideological issues with the industries that currently need it most, like fossil fuels or heavy manufacturing.
Right.
The sheer scale of the decarbonization challenge seems to demand this kind of rigorous, all-of-the-above engineering approach, focusing on what works and what's necessary, even if it's complex or imperfect.
And that leads perfectly into maybe a final provocative thought for you, the listener, to chew on. If we accept Herzog's premise and the broader scientific consensus that we will likely need technologies like direct air capture and other carbon dioxide removal or CDR methods to actively achieve negative emissions later this century, basically, to clean up the mess we've already made because we've likely overshot our carbon budget. And we acknowledge that the current costs for those CDR technologies, especially DIT, are frankly astronomical today. Then the provocative question is, what specific concrete policy levers absolutely must be pulled, starting today, right now, to guarantee we achieve the necessary learning by doing, the R&D breakthroughs, and the economies of scale required to drive those costs down drastically over the next crucial two decades? Waiting is not an option if they're to be ready when we truly need them at scale. That's the immediate policy challenge that needs tackling.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acoptra Foundation.